This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
We're thrilled to have you here for this presentation by Margaret Wertheim, who's been a longtime Cabinet contributor and a friend of mine, for the launch of their new book, Crochet Coral Reef, which is the culmination of a very long-term amazing project about which you'll hear more tonight. Margaret is based in L.A. and is the director of the Institute for Figuring. And we're very happy to have tonight with us also Mackenzie Wark, Ken Wark, who teaches at the New School and who's written a new book, Molecular Red, Theory for the Anthropocene. And they're going to have a conversation about fiber arts, mathematics, and environmentalism. Please welcome Ken and Margaret.
Thank you, Sina. We're just going to start with you. Take it away.
Thank you all for coming, and sorry about the techno problems. Just when you think that technology can do everything that we want it to do, then the most basic things hiccup, and you realize that techno devices are alive and organic too. I'm just going to begin by giving a very brief presentation about the overallness of the Crochet Coral Reef project, and then Ken and I will have a chat, and then we'd love to involve all of you. So just a slight bit of background. The Crochet Coral Reef is a project that is hosted by my organization, the Institute for Figuring, which is based in Los Angeles. And the IFF is our acronym is IFF, which actually, so that's Institute for Figuring. And it's a lovely acronym because it's also, IFF is the logical symbol for if and only if. The IFF is an organization that I started with my twin sister, Christine Wertheim. And basically, it's a synthesis of both of our interests. Chrissy and I are twins, but when we left school, I went to university and studied physics and math, and she went to art school. And we never really saw that as two sort of opposite things. We thought it was two sides of the same coin. And we formed the Institute for Figuring about a decade ago, basically with the mission to engage people with the poetic and aesthetic dimensions of science and mathematics. And one way of thinking about this is that what we're interested in doing is literally giving people a space to play with ideas. So you know how in our society we have these things called think tanks where people go and think great thoughts and write op-ed pieces and books and try to influence public opinion. Well, we think as well as think tanks that there ought to be play tanks. And we regard the Institute for Figuring as a play tank. And one of our concerns is to try to engage people with scientific and mathematical ideas through materially embodied play practices. So a lot of science, if you go to university like I did and you learn physics and mathematics, you do it all through symbolic means, through reading books and looking at equations. But Chrissy and I believe that knowledge of this kind can also be embodied. And the Reef Project comes out of a desire to engage people with scientific and mathematical ideas through material physical play. The project that I think most embodies this, and certainly our biggest project, is crocheting a coral reef. It's a project that we began in 2005, almost 10 years ago now, and what we're doing is literally using traditional feminine handicraft to crochet a coral reef. And we started this project basically while we were having a few beers one night and watching reruns of Xena Warrior Princess. And
as you do.
As one does. And, you know, we were literally crocheting a bit of coral in our living room, and I'll explain to you how you get to that. But we really thought it was a quirky project that maybe a few other people might like to join us in. And 10 years later, it's become a worldwide participatory project that's operated in a dozen different countries, on five continents, and I think it may well be the world's biggest science and art project in terms of the number of people who participate. And if anyone had said to me 10 years ago that I'd still be crocheting coral a decade later, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have believed it. Basically, the project resides at the intersection of mathematics and science, art, environmentalism, community art practice, and also feminism. So I just want to show you, some of you have seen it, but for those of you who haven't, or even some of you who have seen the exhibition, I just want to give you a bit of a visual reference. So this was some of our early work. You can see it really does actually look rather like corals. And anybody who's seeing these, you know, immediately mentally processes that what they're looking at is a reef. This, by the way, is one of that. We have several bleached reefs, which are references to coral bleaching. The project has now been exhibited in both art galleries and science museums around the world. I should say it's mostly been exhibited in art galleries, only very rarely in science museums. But you get the sense from this picture of the scale. Can you see, Ken?
Oh, yeah.
The scale of it. Mm. This one was done in Germany a couple of years ago. This was one of the biggest ones that have been done. But the sheer scale of it can be extraordinary. This was one of our earliest exhibitions at the Hayward Gallery. This was a detail of it, obviously. This was at the Chicago Cultural Center. The Smithsonian. We did it at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington in 2010-2011. And it was the first time that the Smithsonian had ever done a community art project, which is something we feel very proud about. This one, this is also from the Smithsonian, and I'll just make the comment here. This is all done out of plastic. So we have a whole part of the project where we're crocheting reefs out of plastic and other plastic-like refuse such as videotape. Again, just to give you a visual sense of some of the beauty of it. More recently, we've been doing these very large-scale works, which we call our giant coral forest. And again, it's just to give you a sense of the sheer scale that it can be. The project has become a community project. So when, just to give you the formalities, Chrissy and I do a lot of crocheting ourselves, and we make a bunch of reefs like these ones that you're seeing here. And there's a core group of about 30 or 40 people around the world who've contributed their own works to these pieces. And one of them here is Arlene, who is a truly superb, skilled crafter. But in addition to the works that we very carefully curate and make, usually when we have big exhibitions, we work with the community in the lead up to the show 6 months to 12 months in advance. And we teach the crochet techniques, and hundreds of people in the community get involved. Sometimes almost 1,000 people get involved in making their own reef. To date, there have been reefs made in 35 cities and countries around the world, from London, New York, Sydney, to Abu Dhabi, Latvia, Croatia. More than 8,000 people around the world have contributed to making these reefs. That means they've actually put pieces in the exhibits that are installed. To our knowledge, I don't know of many other projects where 8,000 people have actively contributed to the work. And one of the things we feel very proud about this is we have got all of these people into places like the Smithsonian and the Hayward. And it's a very big commitment on our part that all of them are named both in the exhibitions, on the website, and in the book that we've produced. It's to give you a sense of scale. One of the things that is really beautiful about this project, I think, that we didn't realise when we started it, is that, in a sense, this collectively building a reef is capitulating the processes by which actual living coral polyps build reefs. So you probably know that a head of coral is actually made by thousands of genetically identical polyps building the head of coral together. And then thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of heads of coral come together and build something like the Great Barrier Reef. So coral reefs themselves are perhaps nature's most preeminent collaborative project. And the reef project recapitulates that, because these huge installations could never be produced by an individual. It is only when you get hundreds or thousands of people that you can get something on this scale. The project is both an art and science project, but it's also got an ecological dimension, because the reason that we decided we wanted to crochet a coral reef is because we grew up in the state of Queensland, Australia, which is where the Great Barrier Reef is, and at the time we started the project in 2005 was when scientists were beginning to publicly say that the devastation of reefs, particularly signified by coral bleaching, was because reefs were being devastated by global warming. So 10 years ago, the idea that global warming was here and now was still being debated, but it was becoming clear that it was, and reefs were the harbinger of that. So Chrissy and I actually thought, well, we could crochet a bit of a coral reef and bring attention to the plight of reefs all over the world. And Chrissy joked that if the Great Barrier Reef died out, there'd be something to remember it by with our crochet reef. And that was a joke in 2005, but 10 years later, it's no longer a joke. Scientists are beginning to talk about the fact that reefs might genuinely die out within the lifetime of people living today. So if one wants to make an artistic invocation of reefs, why choose crochet? You know, you could paint one, you could draw one. But it turns out there's there's a reason why crocheting is the logically necessary medium. And that's because all these frilly crenellated forms that you see in our work, these are actually what real corals look like. And real corals are biological manifestations of a kind of geometry called hyperbolic geometry, which is an alternative to the Euclidean geometry we learn about at school. And it turns out, although brainless creatures like corals and sea sponges have been making hyperbolic surfaces for hundreds of millions of years, it's actually very difficult for humans to do this. And one of the ways you can do so is with crochet. Crochet is actually by far the easiest way to do it. So here are some real corals with these hyperbolic crenellated forms and some sea slugs. And here's a hyperbolic one. It was an invention of the mathematician Dinah Taimina at Cornell, who figured out in 1997 that you could make physical models of hyperbolic surfaces with crochet. And she did it so that she could teach non-Euclidean geometry to her students at Cornell. But what we did, I'm not going to go into the math now, we can talk about that in the discussion. She did it to teach non-Euclidean geometry to math majors. And when you do these mathematically perfect ones, you get these extraordinary surfaces that embody all kinds of geometric principles that are very hard to describe symbolically. But when you see them on these, you can stitch them onto these surfaces like this one here. And you can prove mathematical theorems literally in this handicraft. But when you do the mathematically perfect ones, they have a sort of slight similarity, and there's only so much you can do. The Crochet Reef Project really takes off when Christine introduced the idea, what if I don't do the mathematically precise crochet formula? What if I deviate? What if I be wonky and aberrant? And immediately what you get is things that no longer look like mathematical models. They begin to look organic. And what we realized is by experimenting and playing with the crochet code, we could bring into being a whole taxonomy of hyperbolic crochet organisms. And the reason these things have so much dynamism is because they're not mathematically perfect. And nature is never mathematically perfect. Nature is, by its nature, deviant. And so the crochet coral reef really comes out of a desire to break from the pure mathematical perfection and go wonky. And look what happens if you start exploring the code and say, what if I want to go a bit out there? What if I'm going to go a bit out there? Which, is, of course, is also the methodology that nature brings into being. And so what I'm showing you here is just some of the huge diversity of the taxonomic crochet tree of life. And several times during the course of this project, we think we've seen everything. There's no more taxonomic diversity possible. And then someone sends in something that we've never seen before. It's out of a new medium. It's plastic bags. This is New York Times plastic wrappers. This one is crocheted out of something called electroluminescent wire, which is a wire that lights. It's covered in a plastic thread, and when you put a current through it, it lights up. This is used by the US military to light the inside of tanks and to lay out airstrips in places like Iraq. But one of our contributors crocheted into what looks like a bioluminescent sea creature. So here is a small fraction of the vast taxonomic crochet tree of life that's come into being through the Reef Project. And again, something that we didn't expect with this is that it has become like an ongoing global citizen-inspired experiment in evolutionary biology. I don't know if life on Earth let me put it this way. Life on Earth has evolved by starting with a very simple code that's gradually complexified to now we get this huge variety of things from sea slugs to giraffes. The Crochet Reef Project and this huge variety of things that our contributors have brought into being demonstrates that complexity in evolution can evolve from the most simple starting points. And we never expected to see this. And one of the things that I've come to love about this is that there is a never-ending complexity here. And it does seem that when communities are given the opportunity to take a simple seed and then experiment it with themselves, that there is no end to the creativity, diversity, and just sheer beauty that a community can bring into being. And we see the project as a metaphor. I think the strength of it is this is a work of art created by 8,000 people. It is, to me, an incredibly powerful metaphor for what human beings can do when they act collectively. And we like to say that the moral or the message is we are all corals now. Every one of us as a human being is like an individual coral polyp. Each of us is really an insignificant entity that cannot, you know, build the Great Barrier Reef on its own or solve the problems of global warming. But I believe the metaphor of this project is just as billions of polyps acting together can build the Great Barrier Reef, and thousands of humans working together can build these beautiful installations. I would like to see this as a metaphor for hope. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Margaret. And it's like, where to start? Because I just think this is a perfect kind of project. And to me, I love the way that you've actually sort of crocheted all of these different fields together so that the mathematics and the biology and a community art practice and aesthetics are not, you know, sort of randomly put together, but they're actually sort of woven together and out of the same stuff. And I do like the idea that on the one hand, I'm a really terrible knitter to begin with, so I never even tried crochet. I have to confess that I completely failed in my attempts. But as I understand it, how you make the hyperbolic surface is, you know, if the line is length n, the next one's n plus 1, n plus 2, or it could be n plus 2, n plus 4, so you just increase in some regular way. So it's an algorithm, right, is how I would understand it. Presumably it ends at some point. So you have a beginning, a procedure, and an ending, and the procedure is simple. But the thing that to me is so wonderful about that particular tactile one going around or the photographs of the actual reefs is that they're actually never quite the perfect algorithm. That when you bring information into the material space and it has to deal with matter and energy. It's always going to be a little bit wonky and curvy. It's the like the swerve of the Lucretians is sort of in there all the time. And that seems to me to be part of then also of something like the collaborative practice of all of the people working together. I'm sure that hasn't gone seamlessly all the time either, and there'd be little adjustments, and some people's stuff is you know, sort of slightly different, and the shapes evolve in different ways and so on. I also love the way it does, in fact, seem to have evolved. Yeah? If you start with these rules of how you would make a certain shape, then you start to vary them, which is, in a sense, the sort of phase space of what evolution does. Yeah, it just, all right, those are the rules. Well, let's try Pearl 2, you know, is it's sort of a metaphor, but also kind of literally true with what happens with how forms evolve. So it does seem quite seamless and quite woven, like the whole thing, you know, kind of a piece, which I do really love. And there are a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, though. And the first one would be, like, why is this happening more easily in art spaces than, sort of, say, science museums, given that, you know, I'm a member of the American Museum of Natural History and I take my kids there all the time. It's like, why isn't this there? This would be the perfect thing. And so not to necessarily use them as the only example, but why does this default to an art space and not to a science museum space?
That's a very deep question, Mackenzie, and it's very perceptive of you to hone in on that. You know, when we started the project, because I'm a professional science writer, that's what I do, and I started the project to communicate about some major scientific issues, you know, global warming and ocean acidification, and also as a way to engage people about the mathematics, and we can talk a bit more about the mathematics if people would like to. But, you know, a primary goal of the project was to engage people with actually learning about non-Euclidean geometry, and we always begin our workshops by having, you know, an introduction to the different types of geometry, Euclidean geometry, hyperbolic geometry, and spherical. And it's really amazing, you know, within the context of learning to crochet, we have really deep conversations about what is geometry, and, you know, no one's going to pass a university exam, but they really do learn a lot of geometry. So when we started the project, Chrissy and our supposition was, if it takes off, and we didn't know if it would, but if it takes off, it's the science world that will embrace it, and the art world, we really wouldn't give a toss. And the reaction has been so fundamentally the opposite of that. From the word go, the art world embraced the project. I mean, literally, within we put up something on our website inviting people to participate with us. And 3 weeks later, we got a call from the Andy Warhol Museum saying, we're having an exhibition about artists' response to global warming. Could we have your reef? And we said, oh, that became the impetus for us to do the first reef, the first, you know, proper installation. And the art world has been generative and generous and loved the project from the word go, and the science world has completely ignored it.
It's a real shame, because it's not made-up science. This is real stuff, yeah? I mean, all of these issues are real, we're talking about. There's, you know, we could stack the refereed articles that would be about each of these separate things. There is a certain question there about how we're teaching science and presenting science.
I think it raises a very big question. And I think that the answer here is related to gender. You know,
women's work.
Sorry?
Women's work.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, I say 8,000 people have contributed to this project. That statement could be qualified. 99.99% of the people who've contributed to the project are female people. We have had a few men, but they could be counted, you know, probably on two or three hands. And I can't help thinking that these two facts are not connected.
There's a piece that, and now I'm going to forget whether you wrote it or Christine, about Women in Computing, that's in the book.
That was before
digital memory, you had core memory that had to be woven, and women wove it. There was a historical moment when a computer was actually a woman with a scratch pad doing the numbers before Turing got a bunch of other people to build a machine that would do it. And then if you look at photographs of that machine and of ENIAC, there's always women actually running them, and all this gets erased from the story. So that's just like a little bit of it that I know, but then it butts up against, you know, if you were to write the code for how you knit an Argyle sock, you know, you really would bamboozle intermediate computing students trying to replicate that. I mean, it's complicated, sophisticated, but you do it with your hands. It's not a mental thing. So what if there's also a hand versus brain thing mapped onto a gender difference that's an issue here?
I think it's a big issue, and I want to point something out, that handicraft is a digital technology.
Digits?
Literally, these are digits. Crocheting and knitting are literally digital technologies. And all of these processes, knitting, crochet, tatting, weaving, they are all literally algorithmic, because it's... should I explain what's the difference between an algorithm and an equation?
Why not? Yeah.
Well, so an equation, well, classically, I mean, there's a mathematician in the room, and you'll forgive us for a little simplification here, Michael. Classically, equations were what described a continuous function. So, you know, the archetypal example is something from calculus. You know, you have an equation that describes a curve. Okay, there have been some embellishments of that in the modern era of mathematics, but algorithms describes a process. So, you know, the starting point for doing hyperbolics is the mathematically perfect one. The algorithm is the following: it's crochet n stitches, increase one. That's it. That's the totality. So n can be any number. So you might crochet two stitches, increase one, crochet two stitches, increase one, crochet two stitches, or you could do crochet three stitches, increase one, crochet three. And as long, it doesn't matter what the number is, as long as you do it at that regular interval, you get a mathematically perfect one, like the one that's circulating. It's when you, and so that's an algorithm, but you could have a more complex algorithm, like crochet three stitches, increase two, crochet five stitches, increase one. And again, that becomes an algorithm. It's a process. And so all feminine, you know, iterative technologies are algorithmic. And so women and men who've been engaged in these practices in, you know, tribal cultures have been doing iterative digital computational technology since the dawn of time. Why has that been erased from the history?
Yeah, and of course, computing is one of my areas, so yes, and it butts onto that and how we've thought the history of computing in a way that excludes all of that is not only prehistory, but history that runs alongside and through it and so forth, and all of that's gone. But I just want to pick up a different thing. You mentioned the Great Barrier Reef, and you've been to it?
I have.
Because I haven't, and I really regret that, because now I feel like I never will.
Yes.
That I feel like I probably even shouldn't, in a sense. And the issue you mentioned is ocean acidification, which is less well known than the changing of atmospheric conditions. But I wonder if you could say a little bit about ocean acidification, reefs as something particularly affected by that, and this lovely site that I now already mourn in advance the fact that I won't see.
So it turns out that there are two environmental issues that are going on because of global warming that are really devastating reefs. And one is the fact that the water's getting warmer, and coral polyps are very sensitive organisms. So they're sensitive to all kinds of stresses. And one is if the temperature gets more than about a degree beyond what they like, then they start to get sick. And another one is that as the CO2... interacts with the ocean surface, it gets absorbed. And so in the last 150 years, we now know that the oceans are now 30% more acidic than they were at the start of the industrial age.
And that acidification is turning out to be a much bigger problem for the corals than the warming. So basically, we're now at 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. And some models predict that if CO2 concentrations go to 450, then the ocean may be so acidic corals won't be able to build their bony structures at all, because it interferes with the basic biochemistry. So the hard bony structures of corals are caused through particular chemical processes. They suck this carbonate substance out of the ocean, and as it gets more acidic, it just interferes with the basic biochemistry, and they can't do that. So it's not that the coral polyps themselves will die, it's just that they won't be able to form these bony structures. Mm-hmm. And I should say, that, and this is pretty mind-blowing, it's not just corals that are affected by that. All shell-forming creatures are. Mm. So crabs and oysters, lobsters are being affected by this too. It's really
kind of serious, to much depending, you know, not least because how much we depend on seafood, and there's a whole chain of things that eat these things, that eat other things, and so on. And
well, it's now off the east coast of the U.S., not far from here. Oyster harvests are down, and it's believed now because the acidification is preventing the juvenile oysters from actually building their shells.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the work is made with plastics and other things like that. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about the... And it says somewhere in the book that you found other people reluctant to use those materials, but that you thought it was kind of important to work a bit with these... what's it called? What's the word for a fibre made from plastic?
Plan.
Yes, plan rather than yarn.
Plan is plastic yarn. Mm-hmm. And we didn't invent that. I mean, I should say there have been people doing handicraft with plan for some time. But when a little while after we began the project, we learned about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, you know, the big heap of plastic, which 10 years ago most people didn't know about. And so we thought, oh, well, as well as doing the yarn-based reefs, we should crochet a response to the garbage patch. So we thought, oh, we'd like to crochet out of plastic. And so we started cutting up our used shopping bags and crocheting a reef. And now, you know, the plastic part of the project is quite big. But as Mackenzie said, you know, whenever we do a community project, everybody immediately says how important the plastic bit is. But very, very few people want to do it because it's tedious. You've got to cut the plastic bags up. And if you're using mediums like videotape, videotape's actually very hard on your hands and the metal oxide runs off, and that's probably toxic. And but we think that the plastic, you know, this is the plastic reef. And, you know, one of the ways of looking at it is that the yarn-based reefs are, as it were, a sort of artistic invocation of the beauty of nature, which is forged over eons, and that we call the plastic ones the toxic reef. That's a representation of the postmodern saturated, plastic-saturated, synthetic-saturated future that we're all heading into. And some people don't like the plastic reef at all. They find it ugly.
And that's an understandable reaction. I wasn't meaning to be critical of that. It's like, I wouldn't want to do that.
But the thing is, you know, it's called the toxic reef for a reason. But it has its own postmodern beauty. But it is confronting, because this is where we're heading.
And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, working with 8,000 people, 8,000 women and 7 men, or however it broke down, to be more specific. And their agency in it and how visible and recognisable their agency is as creators for you and for institutions, and how that breaks down.
Yes. Well, we in many ways regard the community reefs as the apotheosis of the project. I mean, the ones that Chrissy and I oversee and work with a small group of people who are very fine handicrafters to do are very, very finely fabricated, you know. But and the community reefs
are much more wild. I mean, they're like pieces of, they're real pieces of feminine outsider art, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And so they have a kind of wild, unschooled, as it were, rawness to them. And it, but I think they are the apotheosis of the project. But it was really interesting when, from the beginning, when we first started doing the community reefs, all of the early curators had the same response. Mm. And they had two worries. They said, but how will they be quality controlled? What will be your criteria for judging something good enough or bad enough? And Christine, I was shocked at this question. What do you mean good enough or bad enough? It's like every creature is its own reason for being, and every, it is, we have an absolutely firm no child left behind policy. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as something that is not. And the other thing that the, and so we had to really convince the curators everything will be accepted. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that really, really surprised us, and doesn't happen anymore, but it happened in all of, for a long, long time, was that every curator did not want to list the names of the contributors in the gallery. Mm-hmm. So much so, the Smithsonian didn't want to do it. So much so that we had to say, we will pull our, you will not show our work if you do not put the names of the contributors on the walls. And now, of course, every museum wants this, but for a long time they were resistant. And again, you know, it raises questions. Why didn't you want that? What's wrong with the principle?
Yet, although if one followed this through with every other thing that museums do, it would then start to expose invisible labour of all kinds elsewhere. So I'm sort of seeing maybe that's part of the resistance.
Oh, I think so.
It's like, well, who made the frame? And why is the frame separate from the... You start to ask questions if you start to ask what the, the labour is, I guess. But the book has both the community project reefs, but also works that really are works of art by really, you know, first-rate, you know, artists of these particular media. And but do you find any tension between doing those two things or managing a project that has both those elements at the same time?
Absolutely. We, managing a large community project, working with the individual, just let me answer the two parts of it, working with the individuals has on the whole been a beautiful experience, although there have been one or two cases where it was a nightmare experience. But on the whole, the challenges and problems arise in relationship to the community reefs, because any large-scale community art project, what's visible in the exhibition only happens with an enormous amount of backroom management, and managing this complexity of people, and particularly managing the institutions is the difficult part. Actually working with the people is a joy, but having to wrangle people like the Smithsonian has been an unbelievably difficult process. It's the institutions that cause the problems, not the individual people.
Well, from an art world perspective, you did institutional critique with relational aesthetics. So it's like you got like 30 years of stuff, like just all happening in one project, in terms of questions people have asked about what a gallery-based practice might be now.
Yes, and the irony was I'd never heard of relational aesthetics when we began. It wasn't for years afterwards. But yes, I mean, I think that the real challenge of doing community work, community-based art practice, is actually the institutional one.
Interesting.
We didn't write about this in the book because I just made a political decision I wasn't going to. But one day I want to write about the institutional challenges and the enormous institutional obstacles there are to supporting practices like this. Everything from who gets the credit, how is the credit managed, to who's going to do the work. And here's just a very small part of it, which is, you know, anyone doing a big community practice
it takes an enormous amount of work. It takes an enormous amount of work for us, and it takes an enormous amount of work for them. Mm. And so if there's going to be a community reef, somebody has to be the local reef wrangler. Mm. So we, you know, I'm effectively the global reef wrangler, but every time, like when it's the one, the Smithsonian or whatever institution it is, they have to have a local person.
Right. Mm.
And so here's really a big challenge. Does that person get paid? Now, I think the ethics should be that the answer to that would be unequivocally yes. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting these situations where it doesn't happen. And community art practice, you know, we in our society we have an ethos in the, you know, in respect to art that, what was it, a Damien Hirst pickled thing recently sold for $85 million.
Let's just say mad money.
And, you know, but community art practice is often seen as something that should just happen.
Yeah, well, you know, to hell with Damien Hirst, I think this is the kind of, this is what I would choose to write about and think about. So I'm going to ask people in the audience to like marshal your thoughts. I just wanted one comment and one last question. You say it's, you could see it as a metaphoric project, but to me it's actually metonymic in the sense of being like parts of wholes, and it's like it's just a part of a bigger thing, but the bigger thing could actually work the way this little thing works, and that would be progress. That if we crocheted the world, would be better than the rectilinearity of, you know, the Euclidean space of the white box and all of that. So, you know, so to me it's more, you know, parts and wholes than metaphors. But it could be both, obviously. And if you would just like to say a little bit about what next, like presumably this thing has a life of its own now, but how is it in the life of the Institute for Figuring, and what other things would you want to do?
Well, it's, you know, the reef itself, as I said, if I would never have imagined it, it'd be going on 10 years down the track, and it continues to have a life in that there are three new reefs going on now. There's one being done in Minneapolis, there's one being done in San Antonio, and there's one being done in the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, Australia. And we get inquiries from galleries and organisations all over the world who want to do it, and we would like to continue to have that happen to the degree that there can be public support for it, because it can't happen in a vacuum. So the project just does keep going on. Do I want to do other things? Definitely, yes.
It's like you got a tour of the hit album, you know, it's forever. it was a wonderful hit.
The metaphor that we use is it's like you have a child and she says, "Mummy, I want to be an actress," and then you wake up one day and you find you've got Shirley Temple. sometimes Chrissy and I, you know, the reef first of all took over our living room, and then it took over the whole ground floor of our house, and then it took over my life. Our commitment has over the past year has been to getting this book out as a record of the project and as a way of honouring all of the people who've been involved, and all almost 8,000 people are named in the book. And now that I've done that, I feel like I can sort of breathe and say, what else will I do with my life?
Well, on that note, and I just remind you, the book is up the back and is awesome, so you should get one tonight. But I'll ask people if they have thoughts. Yes, right over there. There's a mic there for you.
I have two questions. One is, I'm pretty sure I did see this at the Natural History Museum. It may just have been a one-evening presentation in New York, right?
In New York or the Smithsonian?
No, in New York.
No, there was never been an exhibition. I gave a talk.
Maybe it was just a talk and you brought various things. It was in a big hall downstairs.
Yeah, I gave a talk.
So the other question I have is the work that the actual barrier reef does, mm-hmm. right, for the ocean and whatever, which I don't know what all it does do. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that the crocheted reefs made not of yarn, obviously, but of something that would be similar to the shell, you know, have the same stability, could that replace the barrier reef, really?
Sorry, could the yarn?
In other words, what you're calling the toxic reef, okay, what you're calling, in other words, which has the solidity of shell, right, or bone, or whatever the hard part of the coral is, in the sense that whatever that does, which it provides, I think, space for other creatures to live, and it, the water, you know, breaks the flow of the water in certain ways. Is there any way that you could actually be replaced by what you guys have made? Or could be made, not necessarily by hand, but I mean once you...
Because a coral reef, the physical topography of it is the hard, bony stuff which is dead. So, you know, when you look at a picture of a reef, 99% of what you're looking at is the underneath those hard structures, underneath the surface there, it's all dead, but the skin of it is a living tissue, and that living tissue is doing an enormous amount of biochemical stuff. So reefs are, as you say, are providing physical homes for millions of other species, but there's also a lot of biochemistry of interacting with all sorts of other organisms, and if the corals die, then those ecosystems will collapse, and it's estimated that coral reefs may be home to up to 9 million species. They're the most ecologically diverse ecosystems in the world, more diverse than rainforests. So nothing can replace them.
I have a question. You mentioned climate change many times, and I'm wondering what specifically about your renderings does it say about climate change specifically, or is it more of just to draw attention to the coral reefs?
It's just to draw attention to it.
Okay. Thank you.
I heard you Sunday morning speaking with Krista Tippett, and I just, it just gave me chills, because I think you and Chrissy are a metaphor for the wholeness of every human being, that we try to say that we're either right-brained or left-brained, or we're the scientist or we're the artist, and what you've done here is, as an educator, where I tried to have my students understand that you must correlate. And when I would teach something, it would always be interdisciplinary. And you've taken, this is a manifestation of the understanding that we can't put our brains into silos, that you have to take that understanding of science and find ways to demonstrate it in a physical way, and I thank you for your work. It's tremendous. I love what you the projects that have been done in prisons and because I've done writing in prisons, and I know what you mean about working within the bureaucracy, and so that's great. You're getting women involved, understanding science through the arts. And that's important for many young women who are afraid of mathematics and science. So it's not a question. I just want to thank you. You're really an inspiration.
Thank you. And I should just explain, for those of you who don't know, there have been two instances where reefs have been done by prisoners. One was when there was a reef done in Indiana, and some of the people who were running the project worked over a period of year to have women in prison do a reef. And More recently, just last year, there was a group of teenage girls in a juvenile prison in Denver who did a reef. And we just literally got a couple of weeks ago a letter from the girl, a series of cards and from the girls, because we had mentioned that all of the contributors are in the book, in the names of their reefs, and there's a reef which is theirs, and all these young teenage girls were mentioned. And one of them sent the most amazing letter. She said, "Thank you for noticing the unnoticed." Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, that was the best possible. I thought, well, the National Science Foundation won't fund the project, but Alicia X, a girl who's in there for a juvenile crime, can send me that letter. I'll vote for her any day.
Yeah.
Just logistically, when everything is crocheted, when everything is crocheted, does it all go to you? And if that's the case, where do you keep it all? And it must be an enormous amount of stuff at this point.
I wish, Norman. We are the custodians of three reefs, the first two that were done, the New York one and the Chicago one, and then another one that was done in Asheville, North Carolina. We would love to be repositories of it all, but we simply don't have the resources. As you say, it's a huge just storage. We're spending a fortune on storage. And this is a huge problem. What happens to the reefs at the end? And we insist now that all institutions think about this up front. And usually they resist thinking about it until the end. And then it's like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do with all of this? The only one of all of them that has been, as it were, kept for long-term storage and was constructed to be an installation that could be properly housed is the German one, which is this one that was just that is traveling around Germany and is properly constructed to be easily transportable as art, as an artwork. The rest of them are rotting in people's basements, and there is no plan for any preservation of it.
eBay.
It's a thought.
No, but yeah. But then all the individual pieces get destroyed.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
Mostly what's happening now is institutions are saying at the end of the project, we'll give the people back the individual pieces. But then the whole totality of it is lost. Mm. Now, does that matter? In the history of the world, does it matter? But there is nobody has any plan for preserving it.
It's like an art conservator's nightmare, that image right there. But maybe an interesting one, you know.
Yes.
Interesting one to have.
As a follow-up to that, I was wondering about the three reefs you have. What's your hope or plan for those? Would you want them to go to a museum collection? Or?
Yes. We have them in public storage, and we have all of our own reefs in public. I mean, a big chunk of ours are traveling on exhibit and outrageous product placement here, but the next exhibit is going to be opening on June 21st at the Minneapolis Institute of the Arts, and it's going to be a really spectacular exhibit, so any of you happen to be in Minneapolis. So a chunk of our stuff travels around the world to museums. The rest of it is in public storage in large cardboard boxes, and we would love it to go somewhere where it could be, you know, that properly in proper storage.
So just another practical question. So for each show, is the thought that you like wrangle with this local wrangler, that you find people in the area to create one new reef from the get-go? Or that you build upon something that you already have? Is there, like, how is this curated? As you say, there's three reefs, and then there's additional reefs, and there's a prison reef. But is there always, like, one consolidated for each show?
when the communities make a reef in wherever it is, you know, Minneapolis or London or wherever it is, they start from scratch.
Okay.
So we come in and we recommend the process begins at least 6 months before the intended exhibition. So me or Chrissy will go there and give workshops and teach the local, some people from the local community, the basic techniques. And then over the next 6 to 9 months, 12 months, they teach other people, and the people who learn it send their pieces in or bring them in personally. And then at the end, just, you know, in the month or so before the exhibition is open, then there comes the question, how are you, like, you've got all this stuff, it's, you know, a bunch of pieces like that, you've got thousands of them often, how do you build it into a beautiful topographic landscape? Yeah. And so we've, over the years, developed a huge set of techniques for doing that. So how do you build things like this? And it's really been, that's also been an evolutionary part of the project. So we've had to develop a whole series of techniques for what we call structuralizing. And then, so that's just the sheer engineering problem of how do you make it stand up and give it an interesting topography. And then there's the other question, which is perhaps the more challenging one, because it's easy to give people, we have a whole kit of stuff that we give people, like, this is how you do it. But the real issue is how do you curate it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's really the challenge, is how do you decide what the aesthetic is going to be?
Yeah, and so are you and your sister both often personally involved in this part, or is it that the museums, as you say, is it like a physical kit that you send them, being like, well, you took on this challenge, here you go?
We were very heavily involved in the curation and construction of all of the first half dozen or so. But now they're happening all over the world. So, you know, when we do an exhibition, usually the community in that city or country will do a reef related to our exhibition. But most of the reefs now are happening in places where we're physically not.
So we're
giving the institution a fully developed package of this is how you go about it. And we maintain a huge website, so every reef that's done has a web page and you can go and see pictures of it and all of that. So now they can, you know, with the information we give them and the know-how we're there for advice and stuff, they don't need us.
Yeah.
Have there been any you don't particularly care for in terms of the curating? Not that you have to name them, but I'm just curious how you feel about the end product.
No. Every creature is its own reason for being. I mean, are there ones that I like better than others? Yes. But no, every creature is a wonderful thing.
Are there any gorilla reefs at the moment? Like, are there any that have started without any consultation with you? People have just started them?
Yeah.
The
answer... I don't want to go into this in a public forum, but
we can should we go off the mic?
Yes, please, Sid.
All right, hold on.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you want to talk. If I'm happy to talk about it, I don't want it on the public record.
It's off.
Is it? Thank you.
record now, or?
Sorry?
Go back up?
Yeah.
Or?
Okay. Can I just say one thing before you go back?
Oh, yes.
Wasn't there a department store that shall go unmentioned that wanted to do windows with it that didn't have permission, if I remember correctly, at that point?
That is true, Arlene. There have been a number of commercial concerns who have also thought that they could, as it were, take it. And we have never commercialized the project. We've been offered all sorts of things like, you know, can we put it on restaurant menus?
really?
No, you can't, actually.
So this is proprietary, the design is proprietary, is that what you're saying? I'm trying to understand when you said legal.
Well, this raises a very interesting question. What is intellectual property? Now, hyperbolic crochet is not intellectual property, and I don't claim that it is. Mathematics is an intellectual property, but if you want to do an entire crochet coral reef project, I would like to say this is the result of not just my work as Chrissy and my work spearheading the reef project, but I'm one of the very few science communicators in the world who has devoted a significant part of my career to trying to engage women with math and science. Most of that work has been uncompensated. It has taken me 30 years to develop a practice of how to communicate science and math to women in these embodied physical ways. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to let a department store or a major science institution who's extremely well-funded just step in and say, I'm taking it. Now, maybe I'd lose that in a court case, and frankly, I don't have the resources to fight it. But I'm certainly not going to stand around and let them do it without at least sending them a letter saying, you can't. And what is intellectual property?
Yes, I heard you mention that you contacted the NSF for funding, and I'd like to know more about that. I just learned that the NSF has terminated a very important institute in Minneapolis, where you're going. You may want to ask around about that when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that the funding has, at least in mathematics, has been reduced by something like 5 to 10% in the last few years. So I'm wondering what you asked them and what they told you when they refused.
Could we also have that off the record?
Let's just go off the record.
yes. I didn't actually mean to say that publicly. I just did my
back up?
No. Yes.
Or?
It goes back to when you were describing in mathematics, Euclidean and versus the hyperbolic and geometry.
cosmic, does there exist in, like, is there an absence of an equal sign in like, the structure of the mathematics of that, the way you were describing the differences of the mathematics of form? I guess it's more abstract. It's kind of like
It's a beautiful question, actually.
Because there, if there's an equal sign, that means that this is equal to that.
Yeah,
that's exactly what you're saying about feminism, is that there is an inequality in your ability to gather. There is an intellectual rigor and a lifetime, or you know, half of a lifetime or a third of a lifetime spent pursuing, and you're saying you are not equal. You know, like that hyperbolic form is just process. It's just keep working, just keep going, just keep crenellating. And they're so labial and like, do you know there's something about it?
My God, I'll employ you to write an essay for the for the reissue of the book.
No, but it's
wonderful.
Exactly the metonymic process in Darwinian, the evolutionary part of it. Well, so does there exist an equal sign in hyperbolic, or the algorithmic geometry? Is there an equal sign?
Well,
at some point.
It's a beautiful, beautiful question. And I feel we're in the presence of a very serious mathematician, but I'll attempt. This is a question I've never been asked. And so I'm going to just try to wing this a little bit, and we might hand over to Michael. But, you know, as you say, in equations, there's always an equal sign. But in algorithms, it is a process. There isn't an equal sign, effectively. It's an articulation. It's a symbolic articulation of a process, you know, do this, do it, do it, do it, do it. And it actually raises a point that you referred to, I think, very early on, Mackenzie, is there an end? And often in algorithmic processes, there isn't. Some algorithmic processes have a natural ending, but many don't. And these ones often don't either. You know, you can keep going. I mean, there are algorithms that do end, but no, there isn't really an equal sign. And as a metaphor...
Well, you're the cutting edge of it, then, of, like, making it equal.
Well,
pursuing and pushing, you know,
it is a beautiful... It's a beautiful, beautiful way of thinking about things, is what is equal and unequal.
Well, I think that what NSF is saying is... Or any large... when they don't want to list those women's names or the people, you know, but mostly women, they're saying they're not equal.
Yes.
The power of this institution.
I think that's exactly what's being said. Why is it that when there's an individual artist, there's no question that you walk in the room and the first thing you're confronted with is, you know, name of exhibition, name of artist. Often name of artist bigger than name of even the exhibition. Mm. But why, when, you know, there's hundreds or thousands of creators, why is it a consideration that they're listed? Why is it even a question?
Well, except it's not lawless, though, is it? I mean, it's pattern making, and they're not perfect patterns. They're patterns that respond to situations. So,
but people gathered together in a collective identity, and they were a large enough force. I think it has. I'm not saying that it would be a revolution of crocheters. I'm just saying that they don't want to name collectives because it's more powerful.
Well, I think it gets to what Mackenzie was saying earlier too, which is. And this, I think, is a very big question, not just in the art world, but in all sorts of spheres, is if you open up
the crediting process to more than just, you know, the auteur, then it does start to raise uncomfortable questions about where you draw the line. And, you know, this is the great question that has been raised by feminist artists for 40 years. And the greatest exemplar of this, who is just one of Christian Meyer's all-time inspirations, is Mirella Leder Menoukalis, who's here in New York City. And all of her art practice is about doing the dusting and the maintenance. And she 1970, published a thing called The Maintenance Art Manifesto, seen as she's been in cabinet. And basically, her art practice is doing the dusting. Years ago, she actually went into a museum and said they wanted to do a project with her. And she said, "Well, what I'm going to do is when the museum closes at 5 o'clock every night, I'm going to come and do the dusting." And her point is that somebody creates the work, but it only it has to be maintained if it's going not decay. And who does the maintenance work? The janitorial staff and the uncredited people, but they're keeping the work alive. They're part of the process. Why don't they ever get credited? And she has a really great line, which is just, we should all ponder this line. After the revolution, who's going to take out the garbage? Right on. Who's taking out the garbage now? And most of the people who are doing the dusting and the maintenance work of the arts world are the women people and the darker people. And this is part of her point. You know, who do we acknowledge in the crediting process? And in our project, you know, okay, we draw the line somewhere too. You know, we haven't named the janitorial staff, but we have named 8,000 people. And keeping those lists and keeping the records of those people has been one of the most time-consuming parts of the project.
How many different algorithms are you using to produce all these variety of forms?
Hundreds and hundreds, because, you know, all of these people who are doing all of these different things, like each one of these has a very complex pattern behind it, and each one is a unique thing, and there's no end to the complexity and the diversity that people do. So every time we do a reef, a community reef, some people will come up with things we've never seen before. Now, most of these patterns are not formally written out. You could write them out, but most of the people who do it are just such skilled crafters and they work organically, so they don't need to write it out because the practice is embodied. But you could actually sit there and write all the algorithms out.
Those are especially amazing, those. I think we have time for one more question, sir.
So code maintenance is an important maintenance task as well. And I wanted to ask about the documentation. In other words, does each installation, are they uniformly photographed and the same kind of information gathered about each one so that the website is that kind of a record? I was hoping that the actual patterns would also be there, but you're saying no, mostly they're not written down. Are any of them there?
No. I mean, only the for those of you who want the formalities, we produce this little book, which is the basic introduction to hyperbolic space, the history of the mathematics, and an introduction to how to crochet the basic forms. And then after that, you know, you're on your own, and you know, we neither have the interest nor the resources to write all the patterns out. But your much more important question is the documentation one. And the answer is the project has not been well documented because we simply haven't had the resources to do it. So
I've been photographer in chief, and I have no techno photo skills. I just pick up a camera and go bloop, and we happen to like our photos. But the project has been radically underdocumented. There's been almost no video of it. And that's because we simply haven't had the resources to do it, and the institutions haven't regarded it as an important priority either. And in fact, in the case of the Smithsonian, they refused to give us the right to video our own work.
Could you make it a part of the contract going forward?
We do. We learned.
Is this off the record too?
But still, you have to have the resources to do it. You can put in the contract that you have the right to, but if you don't have the resources, you don't. So we've done our best.
Is Dyna still involved?
Dyna's actually formally never been involved in the Reef Project. She does her hyperbolic crochet, and we regard her as, we always credit her as the creator of hyperbolic crochet, but she wanted to keep her own practice separate, and we've honored that.
Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Margaret.